Hello and welcome to the Medjlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Medjlis. For the last few decades, the biggest outside influences on Central Asia, politically and economically, came from the region's two giant neighbors, Russia and China. Those two countries are sure to play large roles in Central Asia for many years to come, but Russia's full-scale war in Ukraine has allowed, or perhaps in some cases forced, the Central Asian states to strengthen relations with other countries, loosening to some extent the grip Russia and China have had over Central Asia. How much have the Central Asian states been able to use the last 3 years to further consolidate their independence and sovereignty in terms of foreign policy and in terms of economic independence? To discuss all this, I am joined by Nargiz Khasanova, a senior fellow and director of the program on Central Asia at Harvard University's Davis Center, Bakit Bashimov, a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament and former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE and also to India, who now teaches at Northwestern University in Boston, and Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin. Thank you all for being here. And Nargiz, I'd like to start with you. You're in Kazakhstan at the moment. Understanding that Russia is Kazakhstan's immediate neighbor and the two countries share one of the longest borders in the world, do you see that Kazakhstan has been able to separate itself in any way from Russia politically and economically since February 2022? And in what ways are the two countries still connected?
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. It's such an honor to be on the Medjlis podcast, especially on this one. Well, you started saying that there are these opportunities that emerge as a result of the of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and the countries of Central Asia were kind of forced to do it. And I think that's exactly how we should understand then the developments over the past 3 years. There are new opportunities, and there are kind of new efforts to diversify, to strengthen sovereignty, and so on. But these opportunities, they came with a crisis, right? And they are accompanied by a certain set of risks that the countries face, or they might face down the road. And that's something I think very important to keep in mind, that Central Asian states, they kind of, on the one hand, they understand that they need to recalibrate to find the new equilibrium of relations with the key great powers in the region. But at the same time, kind of every wrong movement might turn out to be very, very, very costly. So nevertheless, indeed, they do need to do it, and are kind of calibrating relations with Russia. That's the main challenge in this picture. You said the word distance or separate. I don't think that's really on the agenda. I don't think Central Asian states can separate from Russia or can significantly distance themselves from Russia. It's sort of, you know, given Russia is a given great power in the region, but the task is to weaken vulnerabilities and kind of not to end up sort of in the dead end, right? And for that, they need to strengthen relations with other partners. The way Central Asians have been doing it traditionally, but we all know about the multi-vector foreign policies of Central Asian states. So basically, you kind of something big is happening on one vector, you sort of try to balance it with the other vectors as well. So here, if you try to kind of a little bit redirect and lessen your dependence on Russia in one sector, and with the war, the transport corridors developing, alternative transport corridors became kind of task number one. You need to, well, give something else to Russia. And we do see, on the one hand, indeed, somewhat lesser dependence on Russia as a transit corridor, as a transport corridor, but we have at the same time stronger Russian presence in strategic sectors of Kazakhstan. So I would start here and let's have a discussion.
Okay, yeah, great. Bakit, I'm curious about your thoughts on that, especially, you know, if I could mention that Nargiz said weaken vulnerabilities. I thought that was a good way to put it. And she also mentioned that, you know, there was these new trade corridors coming in. Now, some of these trade corridors have made the Central Asians strengthen Central Asia's ties to other countries that weren't really they were kind of on the margins of Central Asian foreign policy. I'm thinking the Gulf states, for example, and to some extent, even Turkey has pushed up a lot. What's your view on Central Asia's sovereignty in terms of foreign policy and economics 3 years on?
First of all, I would like to just express my gratitude for you for inviting me to many Majlis podcast sessions. And it is my honor and privilege to be a part of this wonderful program, which contributed greatly to the better understanding of the situation in Central Asia. Regarding your question, I think after 30 years of independent development, Central Asian states still in a search of their best identity after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they are maneuvering between the great powers in order to find the best niche between these giants in order to preserve their independence and to strengthen their sovereignty. And just briefly, I would like to mention the following factors which greatly contributed to the strengthening of the sovereignty of Central Asian states. Firstly, it's a rise of China. And I define the rise of China and its influence to Central Asia is one of the significant positive factors because it's enriched the local markets. It supported the rise of a middle class in these Central Asian states. And after that, to some extent, China contributed to the independence and sovereignty of these states. But it is in a maximum in a midterm, but what it will be in a next stage in a long term, it's still uncertain. After that, I think Russia. Russia is hard to define the role of Russia towards to Central Asia. We see that Russia still in a search of its own identity in a new reality in a post-collapse era. Because you can see that Putin tried to reinvent Russia as a great state. And after that, but given the decline of Russian economy, continuing decline of Russian economy, continuing decline of demography, Russia still in a uncertain position. That's why inside of Russia, we can see that moderate politicians like Putin and hawks like grandson of Tolstoy and former Zhirinovsky, who wanted to take Central Asia back and so on. And those who are indifferent to Russia, I mean, mostly it's opposition to Putin, who thinking that Central Asia is a burden for them. That's why it's better to get rid and to set up the visa regime against Central Asians. In that way, I think for Central Asian, the best way to guarantee a sovereignty and independence is to strengthen the Turkic Union of States. This is the best one. And later on, I would like to explain more why this factor is the most promising for Central Asians. Despite the latest move of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, who actually acted against the principles and the meaning of a Turkic Union of States. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, we'll get right back to the Turkic states in a minute, but I want to bring in Timur here for a minute and let him comment a little bit. We've heard about, you know, China's relationship, and I want to do something with that. You're following this. People have been worried about China's influence in Central Asia for years, certainly the economic influence that China has over Central Asia. But at the same time, China's helping Central Asians open up new trade corridors. Right? I mean, China's a big part of this, the middle corridor, which can also translate to be called the Trans-Caspian trade route, too. So that connects to Europe. And China's also helping with routes that connect Central Asia to Iran, Turkey, and the Middle East. So what is China's role in Central Asia now? Has it gotten stronger in the last 3 years? Is it just different than it was 3 years ago?
First of all, thanks, Bruce, for having me. It's a great honor. You know, China in Central Asia has been the source of fears for many people who cover the region and for many people who write about the economic dependencies that Central Asian countries have over China. And the main point of concern is that this overarching economic dependency, especially in the case of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, will transform or has already transformed into a political influence that China can have in the region, which means that when China needs that, it will have a full support of its Central Asian neighbors, whether it comes to China's relationship with other states or China's presence in Central Asia or in other regions. So apart from that, I think another point of concern, which is heard mostly inside Central Asia, but not outside, is that Central Asian governments, the leaderships, will be looking at China as a source of authoritarian inspiration and will be replicating some of the practices that China is using in its techno-authoritarian regime to suppress some of the people, including religious minorities in Xinjiang, to better control the society and to, you know, just build a more effective authoritarian regime. And of course, from the point of view of some of the people who live in the region, it might look as one of the biggest fears that they can have. And unlike Russia, China's authoritarian know-hows and some of the technical details of the repressions are quite horrifying. So from that point of view, I think we can talk about different fears that people have about China's presence in the region, depending on what kind of people we're talking about. But I should say that both of those fears bear some sort of responsibility that sometimes is being neglected by both of the group are fearing. And this responsibility is actually on the governments, on the political and business elites that we have in Central Asia. You know, the problem with China's influence or China's presence in the region is not so much with China, but with what it is allowed by the political elites in Central Asia for China to do in the region. And we know examples of how Central Asian countries can, you know, weaponize their agency that they have to not allow some of its external actors to go into certain direction where they are not welcomed. For example, when we take a look at language policies or the nation building efforts in Central Asian countries, or if we will take a look at the education design and ideology, we can clearly see that one of the biggest external actors, Russia, is not really welcomed into the sphere. And in those dimensions, Central Asian countries are able to limit Russia's presence. And at the same time, we can say that the same tactics by the elites in Central Asia can be used when it comes to China's presence. However, here we come to the weak point that we have in Central Asia, and the weakest point that allows some of the external actors to use vulnerabilities of Central Asian countries against them is that we have political elites and business elites merged together. Sometimes people who control the biggest financial flows in countries are the people who have the biggest amount of power in their hand. And that is why they are very much interested in having prospering business with external actors. And this is the question where their own personal and corporate interests are in conflict with the nation national interests of Central Asian states. And this is the main point of concern, and this is the main point of why people fear China or any other external country, because in essence, they don't fear China per se. They fear that their own elites are not loyal to the national interest, but loyal to their own cynical interests.
Good point. Thank you. And that's a great way. Thank you for helping me to segue back to Bakit and the Organization of Turkic States. Timur was talking about the people being afraid of the way the governments were treating, getting too close to the Chinese. Let's talk about the Organization of Turkic States. This is an organization that's really kind of come to the fore in the last 3 years. It existed, in this form. It took this form just before Russia launched its war into its full-scale war into Ukraine. But it's made a lot of progress, certainly in terms of its image in Central Asia in the last couple of years. They're having an informal summit in Hungary, 20th and 21st of May, for example. Tell us what role the Organization of Turkic States plays in Central Asia now and how its influence has grown in the last 3 years.
I think that this is one of, as I said, promising enterprises of all Turkic nations. Let's take the example of Turkey and Azerbaijan. And Turkey helped Azerbaijan to modernize their army, intelligence, get rid from the influence of Russian institutions, security institutions. And today, Azerbaijan is stronger, and Azerbaijan just took back Nagorno-Karabakh, and now in a process of normalizing its relations with Armenia. And I'm glad that Pashinyan, the Prime Minister of Armenia, trying to just think in real terms and try to set up the, let's say, more friendly relations with Turkey as well as with Azerbaijan. After that, in Central Asia, Turkic Union of States doing and promoting very promising programs like shift to the common alphabet after 1 decade, just promoting different kinds of education through new models. And after that, organizing different kind of festival in order to bring together these people culturally and to remind them about their own common heritage. And it's important. After that, I need to just to underline this factor that Turkey during 2 decades established a really strong military industrial complex and producing one of the best in the world drones, jets, and our military equipment. That's why for Central Asia, it is important to develop relations in that regard. Do not be dependent entirely from Russia, China, or other markets, but from or just diversify its relations in military and security relations with Turkey and other Turkic states in order to create more stable situation for themselves. And after that, you know, for Central Asia, to strengthen this Turkey Union and States, it is important in order not to play, let's say, Western games against China or Russia, not to be involved in some skirmishes between China and Russia, to not be involved in the great powers of rivalry, not knowing their rules and staying away, keeping themselves away from the dangerous games. That's why, you know, demonizing China, it's mostly it's a Western propaganda. And after that, European attempts to just create some kind of investment climate in Central Asia is just attempt to distance Central Asia from Russia and to involve Central Asia in this propaganda games on their side against Russia. For Central Asia, it's important to find its own place, to be sovereign and independent in that, and to stay in that way and strengthen relation with the Turkic state. That's why I'm thinking from the security point of view, military, political, and from in terms of sovereignty independence, this is the best and most promising direction for Central Asians.
Bruce, can I?
I also have a question.
Let's start with Nargis, and then we'll go to you tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. Well, first, I agree with Bakit that Turkey is a very important country for Central Asia, and now probably more than ever. And if we kind of recall Brzezinski's Eurasian chessboard, he was saying that Turkey is the main competitor, right, for the role of being kind of this regional great power. He wrote it in mid-1990s, and then kind of people were saying, oh, it's not really happening to the extent that expected. But now we do see that Turkey plays such an important role, right? And Azerbaijan as well. So we have kind of this Turkic belt emerging in Eurasia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan in Central Asia are kind of leading the effort, then Azerbaijan, and then Turkey, and this is great. But I think the kind of a strong pivot to Turkey is kind of prioritizing the organization of Turkic states might not be plausible and could be even counterproductive for three reasons. The first being that one of Central Asian countries, Tajikistan, would not feel comfortable. And I think kind of what we have now, this C5 format, that's the format we should try to strengthen and not to kind of, I think it's important not to lose Tajikistan. The second reason is Russia. I don't think Russia would like it at all if Central Asia kind of pivots even more toward Turkey. Azerbaijan, that's a separate case. Russia-Azerbaijan relations are different, and also the positionality, right? The geography is very different. Azerbaijan is attached to Turkey. It can do other things than what we can do. And the third one is China. I don't think China would be thrilled with this scenario as well, given its sensitivities with what's happening in Xinjiang and kind of this Turkic solidarity. I think it would be very, very suspicious, and I don't think it would welcome kind of this kind of development. So it seems to me the kind of the most reasonable, the most promising course of action would be to strengthen the C5 format and try to kind of continue to develop relations with the organization of Turkic states, but also have other formats and play the role of the bridge and kind of increase the strategic autonomy. Let's put it this way of the region. So it's C5 with other players.
Okay, great, thank you. We're going to get back to the C5 before the end of the show, but Timur, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on the organization of Turkic states and its role in Central Asia.
Yeah, I actually wanted to agree with Nargis and also raise a question about how does the idea of getting closer into the Turkic world coexist with the idea that Central Asia needs to find its own place, right? In my view, here we are already in the middle of the process where Central Asian countries are getting closer to Turkey, and they are showing all of the reasons and willingness to be part of the Turkic world community without excluding other orbits that they also exist in. And from my opinion, what is happening right now is exactly the foreign policy strategy that works the best for Central Asia, to be everywhere and nowhere at the same time, to be included in all of the platforms that you can imagine and not be associated with only one, because being associated with one, first of all, we've already seen that with the Soviet Union and being the part of Russia's orbit. And second of all, it of course limits the freedom that you have in both foreign policy and with yours in your domestic policy. So yeah, that's my take on the organization of Turkic states.
in that regard, I would like to continue. Thank you for your comments regarding my thoughts on a Turkic Union of States. Number one, if Central Asian states will be obsessed by thinking what ours thinking about their destiny and what they are doing, they will make great mistakes. This is a big mistake when on individual, on a state, or nation level, because they should find their more stable and more confident position in order to protect their sovereignty independence. And that way, you can see that this Central Asia is between Russia, China, and South Asia, and Caucasus and Middle East. In that situation, for Central Asia, it's important to promote this kind of union. After that, I can understand the concerns of my colleagues regarding a rising of authoritarian regimes in these countries. But it is historical reality, and it will take longer time than we think for Central Asian states to shift to more stable democracies. And we can see that it's not linear process. Let's say that you can see that strengthening of democracy in the world, and after that it's getting back and so on. This kind of waves. And today we can see the rise of autocracies in the world. After that, you know, Russia as well as China will consider the concerns of Central Asians more if they will be united better. And for these states, in order to implement their own policies regarding each state of Central Asia, it is important to see them divided. That's why it is important to just set up a common agenda, think about common efforts to strengthen their security and their to protect sovereignty. In that regard, all great powers will take into account their concerns more seriously, because separately they will not address their concerns properly. Regarding Tajikistan, I agree with that point, but it's not about tribalism, Turkic Union of States. It is about just to set up their own common union on the base of a cultural union. And nobody is trying to push out Tajikistan. And all Turkic states were organizing different kinds of political events in which Tajikistan also participated. And this is union. It's not aggressive or union turning against ours. No, it's not against ours. It is union, which is the purpose of which it is to guarantee sovereignty and independent development of states. It is about that.
Okay, thank you. We're talking about Central Asian sovereignty 3 years after Russia launches full-scale war in Ukraine. And my guests are Nikit Pashimov, a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament and former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE and India, who now teaches at Northeastern University in Boston, and Timur Umara, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin, and Nargiz Kasanova, a senior fellow and director of the program on Central Asia at Harvard University's Davis Center. Thanks again to you all for being on the program. Nargiz, I said I was going to come back to you. We've talked about Turkey, we've talked about China, and we've talked about Russia, but I'd like to talk a little bit about Central Asia's greatly improving relations with the Arab world. And certainly this is true in Kazakhstan, right? I mean, last year, President Tokayev went to Qatar. They signed $17 billion worth of deals. Abu Dhabi ports representatives were just in Kazakhstan last week, along with other representatives from the United Arab Emirates. And they signed $5 billion more worth of deals. They're helping them get the route from Kazakh ports all the way down into the Middle East to the Persian Gulf. The same with the helping with the railway systems through Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and down to the Persian Gulf. How would you assess the rise of the Arab world's relations with Central Asia?
Well, it's not just in Central Asia, right? We do see the rise of the of the Arab world, or more specifically of the Gulf monarchies in global politics, right? Big time. They seem to ride the wave better than anybody else. We see greatly improved relations with the United States, right? So they have what counts these days. They have energy resources. They have a lot of money, right? They can organize these platforms for peace talks and negotiations. So they have this diplomatic clout. So they definitely, we do see kind of the rise of the Gulf, and we do see the rise of kind of the Gulf influence in Central Asia, although it didn't happen overnight. Over the past, I would say, decade and even more, we saw this growing cooperation, partnerships between the Gulf countries and Central Asian countries, because there is a good amount of compatibility and they get along. Kind of the ways of thinking are similar. Even on the ceremonial level, I would say, kind of there's a great compatibility. There is the religious factor. So we have this kind of growing, strengthening plethora of relations at the elite level, business level. So there's definitely a good amount of Gulf now in the region. So it's not just the money, but it's also kind of the top political level. It's different types of businesses. There are investments in renewables, growing investments in renewable sector. So it is in. And while one problem, big challenge is the connectivity, the corridor is still not quite there. But if we look at the air connectivity, right, now there are these regular flights connecting Gulf capitals with cities in Central Asia. So the cooperation is growing, and it will continue. It will continue to grow. So Gulf now is in the game in Central Asia, big time.
Okay, thank you. Timur, I'd like to get your thoughts on this too. There's a new element here that comes with growing trade relations with the Gulf states, for example, too. So now they can offer a trade route. So the Russia's got to worry because Central Asia can now reorient to some extent its traditional trade routes. I mean, it's been years they wanted to trade south. Now it looks like that's possible. Now China has to worry too, because some of these Gulf states can throw a lot of money in. They can do the same things that China's been doing. At the same time, the Central Asians are dealing with Islamic states too. So you could say that the Gulf states have an edge in dealing with fellow Muslim states in Central Asia. You had mentioned before that, of course, it's upsetting to China and Russia that Turkey has this organization. How upsetting must it be to China and Russia to see the growth of influence and trade relations with the Arab states in Central Asia?
I understand how logical it sounds that every time we have another additional new partner in Central Asia, that other existing partners will automatically get sad, mad, crazy, or you name it, and should definitely be trying to limit the reach of Central Asian countries towards new partners across the world. But I would say that this is not really happening. Yes, there are some voices in Russia, for example, in the expert community, that's saying that, oh, Central Asia is turning to Turkey. Oh, Central Asia is going there. Central Asia is doing this and that. But those are not the people who make decisions. And the decision makers in Russia, although they follow some of the trends, they understand what's going on, but more or less, they also are confident in the one main instrument that they have. And when we speak about Russia, we understand that Russia is the only provider of regime security guarantee. That's the thing that nobody can take away from Moscow. And Moscow has shown it in January 2022, how it can provide the regime security. I'm not speaking about the overall security. I'm speaking about specific political regime security. And in this regard, no one else for now can replace Russia. And Russia understands that these instruments only gives Russia much more than some of the new partners can hope for. So when it comes to the other partners and the Gulf states, they will eventually find their own niche. They will eventually find their basic and most important partners in Central Asia and will develop the relationship until they reach, you know, a certain limit. And then this partnership will evolve further. From what I see now, energy cooperation is one of the most important parts of the Gulf states' presence in Central Asia. And they're not competing necessarily with Russia or China. They're actually trying to find the mutual interest. For example, when we speak about the green energy projects that Saudis have in Central Asia, they are actually building them in cooperation with Chinese. Take a look at Aqua Power's projects in Uzbekistan, in wind farms. They are, you know, partially funded by Chinese money. And this is also, you know, an interesting detail of how those countries actually cooperate with each other. But when we explain what's happening in Central Asia, we tend to ignore the cooperation part between different states and tend to focus mostly on on competition or rivalry, because this is something that, you know, is in a way cheesy, that attracts a lot of attention. But actually, cooperation in reality is much bigger than competition. And I don't really see how the classic partners of Central Asia, Moscow and Beijing, are being mad or sad about the new countries that are coming to the region.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for mentioning cooperation between outside states. Abakita, you want to say something?
I think that Central Asia's cooperation with the Arab world, especially with Gulf countries, in renewable energy projects, it's a good for Central Asia, but trade still moderate. As I remember, last year it was about $4 billion of all Central Asia and Gulf states trade. I don't think that in the near future Gulf states and Arab world will be export market for Central Asians. Just Central Asian trying to find investments and so on. But one thing should be the biggest concern of Central Asian elites at that situation. I would like to remind, Nargis mentioned about Zbigniew Brzezinski and his book. At the beginning of '90s, I met Zbigniew Brzezinski personally. He came to Central Asia and he traveled, taking cars from Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan and so on. At that time, I spent a good amount of time talking to him. And at that time, he was close to the neoconservative group in the United States. Why I am mentioning about him? Because, you know, rising union between Arab money and the United States military industrial complex, especially on the hands of right groups in America, can create danger for Central Asia. Please, historically, one time they created big problem for Afghanistan within the rivalry with the Soviet Union. That's why radical Islam intentionally was supported in Afghanistan in order to create huge problems for the Soviet Union. That's why Central Asians should maneuver better and to think how they can secure their own countries from this kind of groups in Arab countries in the West, from the aggressive groups who are turning weaponry to the regions where they can get benefits. Because we should not forget that this military-industrial complex still producing weapons, and they will not produce it to keep in a storage. We should use somewhere, and so on. That's why I would like to underline that to important to diversify relations with different countries, but to find where something which will be common. We cannot protect itself separately. We protect because they are weak, all of them weak. We can protect not being in the union with the great powers. We can protect themselves being together with each other and strengthening their security and independence.
Excellent. Thank you, because that we are getting close to the end of the show, and I did want to talk about the C5 and Central Asian unity. This is something that we see, at least on according to what you do see, it looks like it's getting much stronger in the last few years. Pakeet, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the role of the C5 and the fact that the Central Asian states, really since they started redoing their summits again, so it predates Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, but you know, in the last 3 years and last 6 years, there's been a lot more unity in Central Asia. How important is that for them? And do you see it continuing? And in what way?
I think it's one of the important direction in order to strengthen their sovereignty. It's to think how they can create, improve trade with each other, how they can enrich their political consultations in order to avoid any kind of conflicts with each other. That's why I am so delighted to see how Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan solve a problem regarding borders, how today Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan open their borders and let people to trade with each other, visit each other. I am glad to see how many people from Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan visiting each other, going as a tourist and so on. By the way, I was glad to know that for many Kyrgyzstanis, Bukhara, Samarkand, Tashkent became one of the best destinations as a tourist destinations. It's so good. And that's why politically, this is a formula, C5. It is one of the best, and I hope that Central Asia continue in that way. But it is important for them to stay together. That's why I would like to say that I very much regretted how free states decided to just not support the Northern Cyprus.
Okay, thank you. Nargiz, your thoughts on Central Asian unity and the C5?
Actually, here I fully support what Pakeet said. I think we're in a very kind of we're having a very good trend, and I hope it's sustainable, because these are not easy times, but I'm afraid even more challenging times are coming with the climate change and water shortages and this problem and the kind of generational change and the kind of let's see what's going to happen with domestic politics in our countries. We don't know how the situation in Turkmenistan will unfold, or in Tajikistan, because kind of there the level of repressions is up considerably as we know. So kind of there are many challenges ahead, but the kind of the more we can strengthen cooperation now, and I think we kind of it will be good to get more ambitious on this front and maybe start kind of institutionalizing this cooperation and making some kind of very kind of on the ground real changes, and we do see on the ground real changes, no doubt, but something on a grander scale. Now, for example, there is this reform of IFS going on. I hope it will go well and we'll end up with a kind of very good and well-functioning regional mechanism for water management in Central Asia. So if we kind of have certain institutionalization, and it will happen at all levels, not just kind of, you know, at the top level of the government with the ministers meeting, you know, or even parliamentarians, but kind of at different levels, especially business to business, the people to people. So kind of if the whole Central Asia start, you know, getting kind of working as kind of this functional region. So less problems on the borders, the kind of smoother, better logistics in the region, better regulations, and stronger identity, because that's another, I think, important matter. Our regional identity is, we do have the Central Asian identity, but it can be strengthened. And I think that it's important kind of to develop that. Yeah. And, well, now we are organizing a conference, we're trying to organize a conference and a project on Central Asian history. And I think kind of it'll be important to develop a regional history narrative, you know, not to have these kind of five different, often nationalistic, let's put it this way, narratives with some kind of, you know, with some mythology in these narratives. So I think kind of there is plenty to do, but we are on the right path. But I think we should kind of, you know, double the efforts, because the window of opportunity might get narrower.
Okay, Timur, I'd like to hear your thoughts on Central Asian regional unity these days, and how has that helped them in terms of their own independent sovereignty?
I don't know how it's helping the Central Asian countries to be more sovereign, because actually getting closer with each other and getting closer to the integration that, you know, this term is not being used by Central Asian leaderships to explain what's happening between themselves. But, you know, this is clearly, if cooperation goes somewhere, it should go to the integration. And integration is the opposite of, you know, sovereignty and independence. So in a way, it's contradictory to think that more cooperation with each other and creation of this real Central Asia region will somehow built up a sovereignty. But I think what Nargis and Bakit mean is that the closer Central Asian countries will get to each other, the more opportunities inside Central Asia will be used, the better economic development will be possible to reach, considering that all of the, you know, economies will be working with each other, not against each other. But I wanted to highlight the fact why now I think that it's not that Central Asian countries just woke up one night and decided to cooperate with each other. There, of course, were reasons for that. And of course, everybody knows about the change of the president of the leadership in Uzbekistan, which led to closer cooperation. But from my opinion, right now, we have a more representation of a new generation of people in power in Central Asia, for whom more cooperation with each other doesn't necessarily mean going back to the Soviet Union and doesn't necessarily ring that bell. And that is why it's easier for them to go into this direction in the first place. But secondly, and this is maybe even more important than the first point, is that cooperation brings much more opportunities, not only on the national level, but also on the very, you know, practical level for the political elites. Sorry that I'm speaking about political elites all the time, but I think that this is the core of many processes that happen inside Central Asia, and especially those processes that are being dictated from the top. Because we still have authoritarian countries, we still have those people who are taking decisions in a very small circles, and they understand that being closer to each other means that it can create much more opportunities, not only on national level, but on personal as well. And we already see examples of them having trusted relations with each other. The different, you know, corruption schemes that was reported and covered by Radio Free Liberty's chapters in Central Asia portray how representatives of different political political elites across Central Asia cooperate with each other, how they create, you know, some of the businesses with each other. And this is a great sign of how Central Asian countries, you know, getting closer to each other on the very personal intra-elite level, which is not the first thing that comes to mind when we speak about Central Asia as a unity, but eventually it leads to a cooperation within a region as well. So as long as those people will find those practices attractive, I think we will see more cooperation inside Central Asia. And considering that new and more people from this new generation of politicians coming to power, they will continue be doing that.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We have reached our program, unless someone has something else they want to say.
Can I say a couple of words?
Please go ahead.
On this authoritarian versus kind of liberal democratic development, or the issue that both Timur and Paquita shared their thoughts on. I think we're in a very interesting moment, because now, kind of with the second Trump administration policies, with the closure of the with the USAID and kind of deprioritizing promotion of human rights and democracy, and kind of the changes in the funding schemes of, you know, kind of human rights groups, NGOs throughout the world, and so on. Well, I think now kind of there is this opportunity to think and to reflect in the region. What do we need for what, right? If before it seemed like in the early 90s, we talked about the 90s, it seemed, oh, okay, the world is moving toward liberal democracy, more and more countries are, you know, democratizing human rights. Kind of they are everywhere. There is a push for human rights everywhere. Now we and then there was some kind of disappointment that the transition didn't really happen in many places. And then we had the kind of this new authoritarian wave. And, you know, we are kind of on this authoritarian wave now. And now we don't have external pressure, right? Or lessened external pressure. Compared to before, so what next, right? Do we want to become more like Russia or more like China or more, I don't know, some other authoritarian state? Is it what we want? But kind of in the absence of these pressures, we can think what we do need. You know, we cannot rely on external. Help as much as we could before, or on these kind of international norms that were promoted by the West. So I think kind of now it's time for people in the region, for the elites in the region, to think what kind of societies we want to be, what kind of states we want to have. Where do we want our children and grandchildren to live, and how to get there where we want to be? What is our theory of change? So do we want to change, and what is our theory of change? And I think the kind of really the moment is now, because with the kind of with this shrinking funding from outside for all these initiatives, you know, to develop civil society, free media, and so on, this should be people in the region, business people in the region, to kind of start supporting, well, first think where kind of they want the country to go, their countries to go, and actually try to make this happen.
Very quickly, if I may.
Okay, yeah,
Baki,
first you, and then
yeah, Timur. In that regard, just a short comment. You know, my colleagues mentioned about two definitions, business elites and political elites. In some countries, this is not separate, we are together. Business people, we are politicians, and vice versa. And, you know, especially new generation of business people in these countries, as I seen that in the press, in the media, they are understanding if they will not support civil society, good things in a society, human rights, they will create impediments for their own business. A narrow approach to business as just to money-making enterprise, it is still dominant, but we can see also an appearance of a new vision, how to use money to support good things, common goods, public goods in these countries. That's why I hope that this trend will strengthen and create new things. After that, of course, we can see this continuity in the international support of human rights and the civil society in Central Asia. But if you look at this from another perspective, it is a good thing because these countries and people should think about themselves. They should think how they can, by their own, create public goods without external support. We will see how it will go up. And that's why for certain period of time, I expect the strengthening of autocracies in this region, but slowly, because these autocracies, as Timur mentioned, corrupt autocracies inevitably create huge problems for the entire society. And after that, Central Asian society, I hope, will try to resolve this issue and find a better way, combining, you know, good things in a society and they try to democratize their societies and especially their way of thinking.
Okay, thank you. Timur, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, Bruce, you're going to kill us all because we're talking so much. But this is, you know, it shows that we don't want your last episode to end. That's why we don't want to stop talking. I'll be quick. So don't get me wrong. I didn't start the conversation about the political elites and authoritarian regimes just to point out to the fact that the only possible future of the political system of Central Asian countries should be liberal democracies in the Western model that, you know, should be kind of something that everybody should want inside Central Asia. And, you know, that's not, that wasn't my point. I really wanted to explain why certain decisions are made by the people who are in the leadership in Central Asian countries. And to explain that, we need to, you know, understand how decisions are made. That's why I went there. So from this point of view, I totally agree with Nargis and Bakut saying that, you know, as well as, you know, democracies cannot be imposed, as well as authoritarian regimes cannot be imposed on other countries. Every single nation should come to the regime transformation on their own. And if it's happening from the outside, it's more problematic, actually. And we've seen many examples of attempts of regime change from the outside, and it didn't really work well. So from that point of view, I completely agree that Central Asian nations should eventually, you know, come up with the system that will work and will satisfy the needs of all people, not only for, the needs of elites, because what elites actually want is to change nothing and that everything will stay the same, because at current status quo, they are the elites and they don't want to lose their positions. But obviously, the people who cannot call themselves the elites, they are against the current status quo. So that's the main problem of, I think, political science for any society. And that would be the driving force for the change in Central Asia as well.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad we ran long. That's great. I wish we could keep this going. But unfortunately, this is probably the longest show we ever did, and fittingly so. So it is time to say thank you. So thank you, Timur, and Nargiz and Baki for being on the show. Big thank you to Demi Faroli, our Majlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And to end this program, I would like to thank all the guests who have been with us on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Majlis podcast, and all the people who listened to the shows over the last 11 plus years. This is the last Majlis episode. It's been a great time. We've covered a lot of topics over the years. So the best of luck to you all, and keep in touch when you can. Thank you.